Search for the Historical Jesus by Robert C. Newman, Biblical Theological Seminary. Brief abstract to the talk. Wild variety of opinions about the real Jesus. Well, many don't like the biblical Jesus. Others won't admit the occurrence of miracles. So they try to reconstruct Jesus from various hypothetical sources. But the historical evidence regarding Jesus is really quite good if one doesn't reject the miraculous in advance. We sketch evidence from early pagan and Jewish sources compared with the Gospels and the testimonies of Paul. The earliest sources, though they disagree in their estimation of Jesus, agree on several items that moderns often wish to reject. Will a real Jesus please stand up? Is he the Jesus of the last temptation of Christ? Or the Jesus of Jesus Christ Superstar? Or the Jesus of the Passover plot? Or the Jesus of Jesus the Magician? Well, these are some recent examples of attempts to construct a different Jesus. The Last Temptation of Christ, Jesus Christ Superstar, the Passover plot, the Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, Jesus the Magician, the Da Vinci Code. Let's give a quick sketch of each of those and then move on. Last Temptation of Christ was a novel written in 1955 by the Greek novelist Nikos Kazantzakis. Was made into a film 33 years later by Martin Scorsese. The plot looks something like this. Jesus is a carpenter who makes crosses for the Romans. He's obviously rather ambivalent about that whole matter. He begins to believe that he is a prophet and gathers followers, but he's undecided on whether to love or hate the Romans. He finally gets Judas to betray him. And then on the cross, he fantasizes regarding what would happen if he had gotten married. But he finally rejects that temptation and dies. That's the Last Temptation of Christ. Jesus Christ Superstar was a rock opera, 1971, and film, 1973, by Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice. Plot goes something like this. Jesus is a superstar religious guru, but his fame begins to go to his head. He begins believing what others say about him, that he is God or the Son of God, and this eventually leads him to the cross. Well, on the cross and before it, he blames God, but dies anyway. Judas is the only one who seems to speak from the grave, and he also blames God. That's Jesus Christ Superstar. No resurrection. The Passover Plot, a book, 1966, by Hugh J. Schoenfield, a member of the British Dead Sea Scroll research team. Here, Jesus has almost everything under control. He learns to interpret prophecy. He decides that he is the Messiah. He sets out to fulfill the messianic prophecy. He stages a triumphal entry into Jerusalem. He realizes that he is going to need to die on the cross. So he blows Judas' mind by allowing the woman to pour all this expensive perfume on him so that Judas will go and betray him. He times events so that he will only be on the cross briefly, but he is speared by a soldier. That's the thing that he doesn't have under control. However, he does not die on the cross, and he is revived in the tomb. And sends a message by, we'll call him a Mr. X, an unknown companion messenger, to his disciples, and then he dies. That's the Passover plot. The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross is a book published in 1970 by John Marco Allegro, another member of the British Dead Sea Scroll team, research team. If you thought the Passover plot was a plot theory, the Sacred Mushroom and the Cross is a super plot theory. Jesus never existed. Neither did Christianity. Neither did Judaism. Jesus, Christianity, and Judaism are among several code words and covers for a super secret sex drug cult. However, when everybody who is in on the secret dies off, the movements continue, the front organizations continue as Christianity and Judaism. That's the Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. Jesus the Magician. a book published in 1978 by Morton Smith. In this book, Jesus is portrayed as a Gnostic magician. He is possessed by a spirit. He claimed to be deity. He develops a form of self-hypnosis and claims to be able to fly and to teach flying to others by presumably hypnotizing them. He visited heaven and saw God, and he was freed by God from having to keep the law. That's Jesus the Magician. The Da Vinci Code is a murder mystery published in 2003, and more recently a film set in the present. Yet the plot turns on the idea that Jesus was merely human, that he had children, and that the Holy Grail is Jesus' royal bloodline. That's the Da Vinci Code. Why all this variety? Are the Gospels really this unclear? No, as a matter of fact, they're not this unclear. But if you haven't read them yourself, you're a sucker for every charlatan that comes along. Well, why all this variety? Well, part of the reason is that many do not like the biblical Jesus. He interferes with their agenda in one way or another, their preferred lifestyle. Many won't admit the occurrence of miracles. David Hume, back in the 1700s, had an argument which basically goes like this: would you believe a miracle report? Adolf Harnack, writing around 1900, argued that ancient people were ignorant of nature, and that's why they believed in miracles and thought they saw them. Rudolf Bultmann, writing in the middle of the 20th century, claimed that the universe was a closed system of cause and effect into which not even God could probe. I try to answer some of their arguments in one of our research reports. That one is, are the biblical narratives of Easter week historically reliable? Well, many do not like the biblical Jesus. Many won't admit the occurrence of miracles, so they reconstruct Jesus from hypothetical sources. What kind of historical evidence on Jesus do we have? Well, we do have some, and there's a significant amount of it. We have some early pagan sources that refer to Jesus. We have some early Jewish sources that refer to Jesus. And of course, we have early Christian sources that refer to Jesus. Let's have a quick look. Early pagan sources. We're going to look at a few of the earliest. Cornelius Tacitus, who lived from about 55 to 120, wrote a work called Annals. Tacitus was a historian, formerly secretary to the Roman emperor. Pliny the Younger lived from about 61 to 113 AD, and in his letters we have some material. Pliny was briefly the Roman governor of the province of Bithynia in northwest Asia Minor, and we have letters of his written to the Roman Emperor Trajan. We have a third pagan source that we don't know near as much about, Mara Bar Serapion. Work itself, A Letter to His Son, was written somewhere between 73 and 160 AD. Mara, from the contents of the letter, is clearly a Stoic philosopher and a Syrian, but we don't really know much else about him. Well, let's look at what we have from these three sources, three pagan sources. In Tacitus' book, Annals, chapter 15, section 44, Tacitus is describing the events following the fire that burnt down central Rome during the reign of the Emperor Nero in, AD 65. But neither human help, he says, nor human imperial munificence, nor all the modes of placating heaven could stifle scandal or dispel the belief that the fire had taken place by order, that is, by order of the emperor. Therefore, to scotch the rumor, Nero substituted his culprits and punished with the utmost refinements of cruelty a class of men loathed for their vices, whom the crowd styled Christians. Christus, the founder of the name, had undergone the death penalty in the reign of Tiberius by sentence of a procurator Pontius Pilate, and the pernicious superstition was checked for a moment, only to break out once more. Well, that's Tacitus. Pliny the Younger, his book of letters, chapter 10, book 10, item 96, Pointing to the Emperor Trajan, "It's my custom to refer all my difficulties to you, sir, for no one is better able to resolve my doubts and inform my ignorance. I've never been present at an examination of Christians. For the moment, this is a line I've taken with all persons brought before me on the charge of being Christians. I've asked them in person if they are Christians, and if they admit it, I repeat the question a second and third time with a warning of the punishment awaiting them. If they persist, I order them to be led away for execution." An anonymous pamphlet has been circulated which contains the names of a number of accused persons. Among these, I considered that I should dismiss any who denied that they were or ever had been Christians when they had responded, when they had repeated after me a formula of invocation to the gods and made offerings of wine and incense to your statue. In other words, things I understand a genuine Christian can be induced to do. Others whose names were given to me by an informer first admitted the charge and then denied it. They said they had ceased to be Christians 2 more years previously. We also have the response of the Emperor Trajan to this, and he basically says that Pliny has followed generally the right line, except that one should not allow anonymous accusations, and one should not go looking for Christians. Still one more panel here of Pliny. They also declared that the sum total of their guilt or error amounted to no more than this, that they had met regularly before dawn on a fixed day to chant verses alternately among themselves in honor of Christ as if to a god. This made me decide it was even the more, all the more necessary to extract the truth by torture from 2 slave women whom they called deaconesses. I found nothing but a degenerate sort of cult carried to extravagant lengths. I therefore postponed any further examination and hastened to consult you. Well, that's Pliny the Younger. Lastly, Mara Bar Serapion, his letter to his son. From the contents of the letter, we gather that Serapion has been thrown, Mara has been thrown in jail because apparently he said something that one of the rulers did not like, a local ruler, I believe. And he's now philosophizing about that and comparing himself to others who were treated that way. "For what else have we to say," he says to his son, "when wise men are forcibly dragged by the hands of tyrants, and their wisdom is taken captive by calumny, and they are oppressed in their intelligence without defense? For what advantage did the Athenians gain by their murder of Socrates, or the people of Samos by the burning of Pythagoras, or the Jews by the death of their wise king, because from that time their kingdom was taken away? For with justice did God make recompense to the wisdom of these three, for the Athenians died of famine, and the Samians were overwhelmed by the sea without remedy, and the Jews, desolate and driven from their own kingdom, are scattered through every country. Socrates is not dead because of Plato, neither Pythagoras because of the statue of Juno, nor the wise king because of the laws which he promulgated." Well, if we try to summarize these 3 pagan sources, we get this information out of them. Jesus lived in Judea in the reign of Tiberius. That would be about 14 AD to 37 AD, somewhere in that range. A messianic claim was ascribed to him. Notice that these sources, except for the third one, call Jesus Christus, which is in fact a title, Christ Messiah. Right? And the third source, the one of Mara, perhaps understands what that's about, calls him a king. Of course, Christos, Messiah, was in fact a title for the expected king. Messianic claim was ascribed to him. He apparently was a teacher. References to his teaching show up here in the wise laws and wisdom, etc., of Mara, and the teachings that have not gone away, spoken of earlier there. He was put to death by Pontius Pilate and or the Jews. Mara mentions the Jews, and Tacitus mentions Pontius Pilate. His followers continued after his death. They worshiped Jesus as God, see that Pliny the Younger, though they would not worship the gods. They were willing to endure torture and death rather than curse Jesus. That's a summary on the pagan sources. Early Jewish sources. What do we have here? Well, the earliest source we've got is Josephus' work, Antiquities of the Jews. Josephus was born in the 30s AD, and so was grown by the time the Jewish War, 66 to 73, broke out. He was of a well-to-do, prominent family, priestly family, lived in Jerusalem, had been sent on a delegation to Rome, and there he had gotten some appreciation of the power of the Roman Empire and that sort of thing. And when the war broke out back in Jerusalem, he was there, and he was appointed to lead the Jewish defense of Galilee against the Romans. Well, in the midst of leading this defense, he was surrounded by the Roman armies and inside a city under siege. And he eventually gave himself up and had a rather impressive ploy. I don't know whether it was a ploy or not, in which he said to the Roman general, God has sent me a message that you will one day be emperor of Rome. And the general kept him alive to find out whether that was so. Thereafter, for the rest of the Jewish War, he functioned as an interpreter for the Roman side, interpreting when they questioned prisoners and trying to get the Jews to give up rather than continue fighting. So he was a participant on both sides of the Jewish War. He later wrote a work around in the 80s AD called The Jewish War, and then in the 90s a work called Antiquities of the Jews. Secondly, we have a work by Agapius, The Universal History. Agapius is a Christian bishop of Baghdad writing in the 10th century, but he has in his material a condensation of the material by Josephus. And this will be of some interest as well. We'll have a look at that. And thirdly, we have some material from the rabbis in the Babylonian Talmud. The Talmud was finally compiled about 550 AD, but the earliest material in it comes from the first couple centuries AD. In the Tractate Sanhedrin, we have an explicit statement about Jesus, and here and there elsewhere we have references to a Ben Pantera. So we will look at those references to a Ben Pantera and this particular tradition from the period 70 to 200 AD that mentions Jesus by name. Well, let's look at these. Josephus Antiquities, Book 18, Section 63 and 64. Josephus says, about this time there lived Jesus, a wise man, if indeed one ought to call him a man. For he was one who wrought surprising feats and was a teacher of such people as accept the truth gladly. He won over many of the Jews and many of the Greeks. He was the Messiah. When Pilate, on hearing him accused by men of highest standing among us, had him condemned to be crucified, those who had in the first place come to love him did not give up their affection for him. On the third day he appeared to them restored to life, for the prophets had prophesied these and countless other marvelous things about him. As Josephus. Josephus' work has been viewed with some suspicion in the last couple of centuries because Josephus sounds too Christian. We have no explicit evidence otherwise that Josephus ever became a Christian, not that we've got much evidence about Josephus' life, the three suggestions that have been made are that this passage wasn't in Josephus at all, it was invented by some later Christian, or two, this passage was in Josephus, but it has been Christianized. It was not so Christian in its original form. And the third is that Josephus perhaps became a Christian late in his life, and this represents his view of Jesus after that particular time. Well, we move on to Agapius' Universal History, and here's what we have. Similarly, Josephus the Hebrew, at this time there was a wise man who was called Jesus. His conduct was good, and he was known to be virtuous, and many people from among the Jews and other nations became his disciples. Pilate condemned him to be crucified to die, but those who had become his disciples did not abandon his discipleship. They reported that he appeared to them 3 days after his crucifixion, that he was alive. Accordingly, he was perhaps the Messiah concerning whom the prophets had recounted wonders. Now, the striking thing about this is, one, it shows that at Agapius' time and over in Baghdad, this account of Josephus regarding Jesus was in the text. It also notes that there's no hint of Jesus being God, or even a direct affirmation by Josephus that Jesus was the Messiah, or that he rose from the dead. Instead, he's just a wise man called Jesus. Perhaps he was the Messiah, says Josephus in this account, and rather that he rose from the dead, his disciples did not abandon his discipleship. They reported that he appeared to them 3 days after his crucifixion, so a number felt that this is an indication that Agapius, since he's a Christian, would not have been likely to scale down Josephus' account, that Josephus' account was in fact a little more neutral than the version of it that we have in our Greek Josephus that survives to us today. Babylonian Talmud and a early Greek opponent named early Greek opponent of Christianity named Celsus. The Babylonian Talmud and other early Jewish literature occasionally refer to an opponent named Ben Pantera. The pagan author Celsus, writing about 150 AD, in his anti-Christian work The True Account, says that Jewish sources claim Jesus is the illegitimate son of a Roman soldier, Pantera, and the Jewish girl, Mary. The explicit reference we have to Jesus is in the Babylonian Talmud Tractate Sanhedrin, page 43a. On the eve of Passover, Yeshua was hanged. For 40 days before the execution, a herald went forth and cried, "He's going to be stoned because he has practiced sorcery and enticed Israel to apostasy. Anyone who can say anything in his behalf, let him come forward and plead on his behalf." But since nothing was brought forward in his favor, he was hanged on the eve of Passover. So there's three sources that come from Jewish background. A summary on these Jewish sources. Jesus lived in Judea during the rule of Pontius Pilate. Pontius Pilate was governor for about 10 years, from 26 to 36 AD. His birth was alleged to be illegitimate. This is the hostile Jewish source, but certainly has a picture of an unusual birth. And by the way, the Gospel of John has hints that this was the view of Jesus' opponents. "Aren't we right," they say, "in calling you a Samaritan? And we know who our father is," etc. So this is nothing that contradicts what the Gospels say about what was going on at Jesus' time, but merely shows that there was controversy over Jesus. His character was, in fact, controversial, and we see that in the Jewish sources. Josephus pictures him rather favorably, and the Talmud pictures him very negatively. We see the same thing in the pagan sources, that Tacitus and Pliny see him negatively, but Mara ben Serap, or Serapion, sees him positively. The character was controversial. He worked miracles, also controversial. Definite reference to signs and wonders in Josephus, and certainly hints of that in Agapius, and in the Talmud it's used as sorcery. He gathered followers who considered him the Messiah. That much we can clearly see from the Josephus and Agapius, etc. And the Babylonian Talmud pictures him as leading Israel astray. So obviously claimed him to be some kind of a false claimant of some sort, whether a false prophet, false messiah, something of that sort. He was condemned by Pilate, accused by the Jews. That's exactly what the Greek Josephus says. The Agapius version of it, which is, however, condensation, doesn't mention the Jews. And the Babylonian Talmud doesn't mention Pilate, but has it as a religious condemnation. He was hanged, crucified, on Passover Eve. Some kind of picture that we see in the Gospels as well. His resurrection was reported on the third day. That's a summary on the Jewish sources. Early Christian sources, well, we have the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. Extensive works look like primary sources, and as early as anything we've got, we think all of them were written no later than Josephus was originally written, and we have much earlier manuscripts than those. We have even earlier the letters of Paul, but they are not primarily about the ministry of Jesus on earth, but he was an early opponent of Christianity, and he became a Christian when Jesus appeared to him, and he makes a number of offhanded references to Jesus as well. Well, to summarize, the Gospels would be a huge project, and we leave you to recall what you already know about that or to go do some research on that particular subject. But we say a little bit about what Paul has to say about Jesus in his letters. He says, first of all, that Jesus is God. Doesn't make a big deal of it, but it comes up again and again. Comes up in Romans, comes up in Colossians. He points out that Jesus is also human, a descendant of David. That Jesus had brothers, including one whom he names, James. That Jesus taught and appointed apostles. That Jesus instituted the Lord's Supper. And gives us an explanation of the significance of that supper. That Jesus is picturing his death as a payment for the sins of others. That Jesus was killed by rulers. That he rose from the dead on the third day. And that he has ascended to heaven. Now, if we try to pull together these sources we've looked at, here's what we get. The earliest sources, though they disagree in their estimation of Jesus, agree on several items which moderns often wish to reject. They agree that Jesus made a messianic claim. Yet many today want to claim that Jesus never had any thoughts of that sort, but they have no support from that, from ancient documents that deal with the matter. These earliest sources, though they disagree in their estimation of Jesus, agree that Jesus worked miracles. His opponents saw it as magic, sorcery, satanic, and his followers saw it as from God, but they agree that he worked miracles. That, of course, is not popular to those who believe that the universe is all there is or was or ever will be, and that not even God could intervene in the cause and effect structure of the universe. But the early sources all have Jesus working miracles. These sources agree that Jesus was put to death by Roman Jewish collaboration. See that both in the Roman sources, the Jewish sources, and the pagan sources. Even though many today would like to blame the Romans alone, or blame the Jews alone, depending on one's own view about the Jews or the Romans. We see something else. One can reject miracles only by discarding the very evidence from antiquity that points most strongly in this direction. Yes, if miracles do not occur, the Christian Gospels cannot be true because they've got many miracles in them. But the very Christian Gospels may be one of our strongest evidences that miracles do in fact happen in history, and particularly in places where, points in time, where miracles are very needful to indicate the significance of what is going on. If miracles are not rejected in advance, the Gospels look very good by the methods used by secular historians. Yes, secular historians usually reject miracles in advance. But if you remove that item, say, well, we don't know whether miracles happen or not, let's see, and then apply the tests of secular historians to the Gospel accounts, the Gospels look very good. And the method used by liberal New Testament scholars, if you remove the one that miracles don't occur, and use their other tests of multiple attestation in the various sources, and tests of things that would go against expectations and things of that sort, the Gospels look very good. This is sketched for us by Craig Blomberg in his book, The Historical Reliability of the Gospels. We make another conclusion, and that depends upon what I think is the fact that we live in a world that is not just this visible world we can see, but an invisible world as well, that involves the supernatural. And a world that includes some very powerful forces in rebellion against God. And we ask ourselves, what is Satan's strategy in these things we've been looking at here today? And a rather clever answer, which I think is a right one, is given by C.S. Lewis in his book, The Screwtape Letters, where he has put in the mouth of one of Satan's henchmen, our strategy is to keep people off balance by bringing out a new Jesus every few years to distract them from the Jesus of the Gospels and keep their attention away from the historical records. C.S. Lewis presented for us a good situation that helps us think through this whole matter. It's called Lewis's trilemma. Dilemma is when you've got two alternatives and you're having trouble trying to figure out which one to go with. A trilemma is when you've got three alternatives. Lewis says, I'm trying to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about Jesus. Namely, I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. Well, Lewis says, this is the one thing we must not say. A man who is merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on a level with a man who says he's a poached egg, or else he'd be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman, or something worse. Well, the standard way of trying to avoid this trilemma today is to argue that Jesus never said these things, that this is all the work of later followers, etc. And yet, the sources we've looked at already show that the very early followers worship Jesus as a god, though they would not worship the pagan gods. As we suggest in other of our PowerPoint talks here, the Old Testament prophecies regarding the Messiah zero in on Jesus in a striking way, and they have some things that indicate that this Messiah is God. And every strata, if you like, every stratum of the New Testament materials pictures this Jesus as more than merely a man as well. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman, or something worse. What are you going to do with Jesus? Is he a liar? Is he a lunatic? Is he the Lord of all? There's no place for postmodernism here. He either is or isn't what he claimed to be. If he is what he claimed to be, you are going to have to face him one day. What are you going to do with Jesus? That's the question. The choice is yours.